Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life Money Maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that lie in the path to prosperity. And just a quick update, we've recently launched the first of our private podcast series. And if you're interested in listening to the discussion on the topic of litigation funding with Robert Rothkopf of Balanced Legal Capital and myself, then you can find the conversation on our website, moneymazepodcast.com.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
Over the past decade, about 80 cents of every dollar that has gone into the US investment industry has ended up at Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock. As a result, the combined stake in S&P 500 companies held by the big three has quadrupled from about 5% in 98 to north of 20% today. The global index tracking fund industry now manages nearly $17 trillion, making it over twice the size of the hedge fund and private equity industries combined. Index funds have revolutionized investing. Those lines are from a new book, Trillions, Why Passive Investing Beats Active, written by my guest, Robin Wigglesworth, Financial Times global finance correspondent. Robin focuses on the biggest trends reshaping markets, investing, and finance across the world. So Robin, hello and welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I know you live in Oslo, Norway. Your wife is Norwegian. So velkommen til show I dag.
Tusen takk for det. Thanks for having me on. It's a real privilege.
Well, it's great. My career has been rooted in active investing, but like many, I have embraced passive elements for parts of the allocations I've been responsible for. You were kind enough to share the draft of your book about to be released, and I will say candidly that I think it is a brilliant analysis of the history, the evolution, and evidence of passive investing and the revolution it unleashed. So today I hope we're going to understand the forces that drove the creation of the passive investing industry, the key players and the roles they played, the data and what it shows us so starkly about passive v active, the criticisms and dangers, where we might be going in the investment world, and more. But Robin, before that, I'm guessing you didn't grow up dreaming about financial journalism and writing an opus on index investing, did you?
Well, initially I wanted to be a physicist. And then I realized, although I was pretty good at maths, I was no better than being able to be maybe a mediocre physicist. And that sounded pretty dull. So then I wanted to be a war correspondent. So my first jobs were in the Middle East.
So you have been a successful journalist for a long time. But what drew you into financial journalism?
Well, I was doing my master's at the LSE in London, actually thinking that I didn't want to go into journalism anyway, because parts of it sounded pretty dull. But I was working as a sub-editor at The Guardian. I saw a job for a financial journalist in a small business-to-business publisher in Dubai. And since I was studying in the Middle East, I was intrigued. I mean, Dubai is probably the least Middle Eastern part of the Middle East, but I thought it could be interesting. I thought finance and economics was interesting. Didn't know too much about it, but journalism is of many ways a good excuse to learn. So that was my first job, working as a banking correspondent and then primarily actually covering Islamic finance down the Middle East.
So let's turn to passive investing, which now, as I said, accounts for more than $17 trillion, which is essentially, I think, equal to the entire gross domestic product of the US. And every year, as you've pointed out in your book, hordes troop to Omaha, Nebraska to listen to Warren Buffett give very simple advice, which is just buy an index fund. But to understand this journey, let me ask you to start the story. How and why did this begin?
Well, you can trace the lineage back, I think, to a French mathematician called Louis Bachelier, who's sort of the father, the granddaddy of financial economics. He worked in France in the 1800s, early 1900s, first mathematically showed how stocks seemed to actually take what was looking like a bit like a random walk, like a drunk person stumbling home, as it were. And from that, that was the wellspring that many people then turned into a theory of why stock markets seem pretty random, how most active managers actually do a bad job overall. And then that became the wellspring that the index fund sprang from in the early 70s.
So you got names here that many of us have read about. You got Markowitz, you got Farmer, before you get to Bogle. But just draw this together, please.
Yeah, so Louis Bachelier is, I call him the granddaddy. He's the intellectual godfather of the index fund in my mind. But from Bachelier, you can draw a lineage from him to the intellectual ferment of Chicago and the University of Chicago's famed economics department. Because Bachelier was well known in France, or reasonably well known in France, but nobody in the US knew him until Paul Samuelson, a very famous American economist, randomly came across his thesis on the random movement of stocks. So he, and together with another famous French-American mathematician called Benoit Mandelbrot, they helped bring this idea into the intellectual and academic sort of lifeblood in the US. And at the same time, especially after the 30s, people started realizing a lot of professional investors, professional analysts actually did a very cruddy job. And this is when Fred Schwed famously wrote the book, We're the Customer's Yachts. That was after the Great Crash and the Great Depression. So in the 30s and 40s, there started being, for the first time, a quantitative study of how professional investors did. And lo and behold, all the studies led by people like Alfred Cowles, who led the Cowles Commissions later on, showed that they did a pretty bad job. There was no evidence that professional stock market forecasters could actually forecast. And then people cobbled together the theory of what became efficient markets. The random market walk became efficient markets. And the Gene Farmer, who studied both Paul Samuelson's work and learned from Benoit Mandelbrot in Chicago, and then the realization that active managers in many ways did a poor job, and that became together in around 1971, the first index fund at Wells Fargo at the time.
But I think it was Robert Shiller who makes the comment that it was back as far as 1957 when Standard & Poor's launched the first computer-calculated stock index, and it was sort of beginning of the electronic era in finance. But we've all known, we're going to talk some more about Vanguard, and I was intrigued to know that the Vanguard is actually named after Nelson's flagship at the Battle of the Nile. But it was Jack Bogle who had a unsuccessful or a turbulent start at Wellington, said the maths will never let you down. How could he assert that?
I mean, Bogle was an active fund enthusiast. Like, he was the wonder boy of the asset management industry. He was the head of Vanguard at an incredibly young age, and he loved active funds. He actually wrote a pseudonymous attack on the very idea of index funds, calling them utterly ridiculous under a pen name, John Armstrong. So it was only later in his life he became the zealot that we now know. His view was that fundamentally the mathematics are hard to fight. On average, the average investor has to get the market average. And if you then control for costs, the average cheapest investor is going to do better than the average investor if you invest actively.
And I think it was Professor Malkilov of Princeton who said the intellectual case for indexing is airtight. But how did it take for that to be accepted?
Very long time. I mean, you have to realize that this is like selling cars to horse breeders. People thought the idea of just being lazy, being passive, was just ridiculous. Like, obviously, the name of the game, as Ned Johnson Fidelity said at the time, was to be the best. Just admitting you were crap at your job didn't really appeal to anybody. Nobody wants to be an average journalist. Nobody wants to be an average investor. Nobody wants to be an average doctor. So the whole point of, you know, the human condition is to try and be a little bit better. But the thing is, Malkiel and others have pointed out that investing is one of those few areas where actually sometimes just being lazy and being passive actually makes you better than average, given the costs involved of portfolio management, back office, compliance, administration, and just trading costs. And trading costs back in the day were astronomical. So on average, if you were in an active fund, even if your fund actually did better than the market average, you could often end up doing worse net as an investor because of the costs involved. So his view, Malkiel and others, was basically go with the blindfolded monkeys, as Malkiel famously called it, and invest in an index fund. They weren't really around until the 70s, but suddenly then there was a wellspring of them that came out of Wells Fargo, Battery March, and American National Bank of Chicago, initially only for pension funds, of course. Bogle was the one that brought it for the masses.
So as you started this study, where were you? Were you agnostic when you started? What was your own journey in this analysis?
I always differentiate myself from what I call the passive jihadist, in that I do believe there is alpha. I am not an efficient markets zealot. I definitely think there are above average investors that can consistently and have consistently beaten the market. The problem is, I think it's very hard to know that ahead of time. And the persistence, basically like how often somebody is in the top decile for 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years running, is abysmally low. And the people that are really good at this, they don't tend to rent out their skill more cheaply. If I could put my entire net worth into, let's say, a Millennium or a Citadel or a Medallion, the flagship hedge fund of Renaissance, I would do so. But given that I can't, that these funds are capacity constrained, I think the vast majority of investors should certainly, in very efficient liquid markets like in equities, invest passively, and they will do better than the average active investor over time.
So we've had a number of very successful long-term asset managers with active equity strategies who have proved that it is possible. But did your data show you what percentage of managers over time do outperform?
It varies from asset class to asset class, as you would expect. So it is lower in large cap US equities, for example, like the S&P 500. Active does better in, let's say, high yield bonds or emerging market equities. But broadly speaking, over a 10 to 15 year period, only around 10 to 20% of active managers beat their benchmarks after costs.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those niche asset categories a little bit later on. But I just want to go back to this explosion, because you had the large body of the investment industry governed by self-interest that was going to be opposed to this weird quantitative approach towards the markets. But how do you explain the takeoff?
Well, it was basically the bear market. Bear markets reveal all sorts of fault lines. And in the 70s, late 70s, so if we turn back to the 1960s, it was the go-go era. This is the birth of the first superstar stock pickers. Jerry Tsai, Fred Alger. This was like time when Fidelity became like the giant that it is today. And everybody wanted hot growth stocks. So Xerox at the time was really hot and sexy. Boring funds, typically Wellington, for example, where Jack Bogle worked at the time, just weren't that interesting. They weren't doing that well. Conservative funds were out. And anyway, these mutual fund managers might be taking 1, 2% a year as a fee for assets under management, but they were kind of churning out 20, 30% returns. So who cared about the fees? But then the bear markets were long on-off bear market from the late 60s to the mid 70s, which, adjusted for inflation, was the worst bear market since the Great Depression, really revealed how a terrible job many active managers did. They had produce really great returns in the bull run by basically leaning into risk. They were taking really punchy bets. And if you adjusted for the volatility, they weren't actually doing that well. This was stuff that people could, for the first time, quantify using computers. In the 60s, people just didn't know how well your fund manager did against the index. He said the S&P 500 had been around for a couple of decades then, but they weren't well known. And everybody knew the Dow Jones, which is a terribly constructed index. It's weighted by price rather than the market cap. So it's fairly easy to superficially beat the market. But pension funds, above all AT&T, started realizing how terrible this was for them. So AT&T was this giant telecoms monopoly de facto, but the pension system had been split into little bells, baby bells were called. So Marbell was the mothership, and the baby bells were separate pension funds investing. And they invested in, let's say, 10, 20, 50, 100 different active managers. But they did an overall study and realized a lot of their active managers were essentially just swapping bananas. So I sell a banana to you, you sell an apple to me. And overall, the trading costs and the management fees just cost AT&T's pension system enormously over the years. So AT&T and the baby bells were the prime movers behind the move to index on the pension fund side. And the individuals didn't come until decades afterwards, really.
We now look at these oligopolistic players that have emerged, which again, you can argue seems relatively straightforward, but anybody could have pursued that. What was so particular about Vanguard and Bogle that allowed them to capture such a dominant market share?
The first three that started indexing for institutional investors, primarily pension funds, were Wells Fargo, Battery March in Boston, American National Bank of Chicago. And not to be mean, but these were like third, fourth tier financial institutions. Wells Fargo is not the Wells Fargo of today. It was a crappy San Francisco bank. It was fairly mediocre. It was small. You had to be a challenger. You couldn't be an incumbent. Incumbents don't like to challenge and disrupt themselves. And the same way with Vanguard, the secret there was that Jack Bogle entered into a disastrous merger with a go-go growth manager in the 60s that basically imploded in his face and got himself sacked. So he managed to set up as a desperate Hail Mary a company that would be owned by Wellington's own funds that would just do administrative work called Vanguard. So this was just an administrative unit. It wasn't allowed to do investment management. But he desperately wanted to get back at the people that sacked him. So he argued with a straight face, well, passive isn't management. We're not actually doing any managing. We're just tracking an index. This is something we could do. And it was purely a strategic ploy. Bogle in later years turned into this Genesis guy. Passive is the best in the world, but it wasn't at the start for him. It was purely a strategic ploy to get back at the people that sacked him. So he started an index fund at Vanguard as a way to differentiate Vanguard from Wellington and become something more than just an administrative unit.
One part of your book that particularly intrigued me is the BlackRock today is a byword for passive investing. It struck me, it happened somewhat fortuitously post the great financial crisis and the deal with Barclays between Fink and Diamond. Just tell us a little bit about what happened.
BlackRock, I think one of the things that people don't appreciate is like Larry Fink, I think has one of the finest strategic minds in the asset management industry. He sniffs out trends and understands them earlier than many other people. So BlackRock first started sniffing around ETFs, whilst even Barclays, which owned BGI, which was the leading ETF provider and index provider, wasn't quite convinced this was going to become a worldwide phenomenon. But BlackRock kind of realized it, and they were sniffing around, and they were looking at various things to do. And then the financial crisis just happened to throw this enormous opportunity right into their lap. Now, it still cost them a lot of money. We're talking about $14 billion in 2009, which many people at the time thought was utterly insane. The world was still recovering from the financial crisis. But essentially, BlackRock just moved quicker and was smarter about it and managed to exploit the situation better than others and saw where the world was heading before many other people.
So we had this explosion in the indexing and the explosion and multiplicity of ETFs, exchange-traded funds. If you were summarizing their essential benefits, because they're different tax regimes and there are different regulatory regimes, but in essence, how would you describe their ultimate benefits?
Well, I tend to split the world of index funds into two distinct categories, which is like one thing is the old school broad index fund that tracks the FTSE 100 or the S&P 500, typically in a mutual fund structure, the kind of stuff that Bogle sold en masse and Vanguard still is, you know, one of the world's leading companies in. And the advantage there is that investing is one of the few walks in life where it pays to be a little bit lazy. It doesn't pay to get cute. Even active managers are terrible at market timing. They sometimes can be really good at stock selection, but bad at portfolio construction. Broadly speaking, investing is, for the vast majority of people, an area where it pays just to be lazy and buy a few select group of very broad, diversified, and cheap index funds and forgetting about it until basically the day you retire and periodically rebalancing that maybe just before or afterwards. ETFs, increasingly, are the dominant vehicle for passive investing. But I don't think people have grasped quite how far it is a different product as well. The ETF is just a wrapper. It's a very supple, flexible wrapper that you can put anything into. So primarily people put passive strategies, but you can put anything into it. And that is where, you know, we're really seeing the revolution unfold. And that's having a huge impact and rippling through the broader financial industry is how ETFs are reshaping markets. So you can put bank loans in there. You can put carbon credits in there. You can put active strategies in there. You can put a boring plain vanilla S&P 500 tracking strategy in there. You can put anything in that. There's a lot of cool stuff you could do with that, but there's also lots of dumb stuff you can do, like buying triple levered inverse ETFs that frankly, sometimes even the architects don't have a good grasp of how function at times of stress.
Well, we're going to come back to some of those darker sides a little later on, but I want to narrow the focus from the developed markets and why passive wins to the emerging markets. We know it's where the faster growth is. We know that's where more companies are emerging. And whilst GDP growth doesn't correlate sort of in a linear fashion to rising equity market, it's clear where the wealth creation is accelerating. And we take a place like China, where I believe I'm right in saying about 40% of the index is unresearched. Isn't that the perfect location for active investors?
Very much so. I mean, if you think about it, turn back the clock to the 60s when index funds were invented. CFAs were rare. There weren't that many CFAs. There were very few MBAs. And having a PhD in economics just made you seem like a god. But these days, just having a PhD in economics won't necessarily get you a job in investment management. I mean, probably you will, but you won't be so fought after. People want programmers, people that know Python, people that know that Python is not just a snake, basically. Mike Mabuson, who used to be at Morgan Stanley and Credit Suisse, back in Morgan Stanley now, used to be at Credit Suisse, has a great metaphor for this, that you want to play easy games. You want to play games you win, not hard games. And playing in highly liquid, highly efficient markets like the S&P 500 or the FTSE 100 or even most equity markets is really difficult. You want to go to the easy games. And markets like China or parts of the Middle East or Africa, which is overwhelmingly retail, like essentially that's the dumb money that smart professional investors feed off. And there are just fewer dentists investing their money themselves these days in the US. But in China, there's lots of them. That's why those markets tend to do better for active managers than, yes, the US or the Europe.
We always used to blame bad investments on the Belgian dentists, but I could never figure out why there were so many dentists in Belgium. However, Robert, being in an index is one of the key issues that we're sort of grappling with. And you make two interesting analogies I'd like you to expand. One is Tesla and the other is Greece. Tell me a little bit about your considerations there.
Tesla was an unusual one that index providers, sometimes the hidden plays in all this. We focus a lot on Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street, the big three in index funds. But of course, they essentially outsource a lot of the management to index providers. These are smart people that do try to do the right thing, but inherently, there is always going to be an element of discretion. The S&P 500 is not made up of the 500 biggest companies in the US at any given time. It's sometimes not even made up of just 500 companies. So Tesla was a weird one where the S&P needs a company to be consistently profitable, typically sort of 2 or 3 quarters of profits. Now, obviously, when the S&P 500's rules were articulated, this was a very low-hanging fruit. The idea that you'd even list a company that wasn't profitable was insane. Why would you go public if you couldn't show any profits? But Tesla and, you know, many technology companies completely ripped up that rule book. And Tesla was never really profitable. But yet it grew to be this giant market cap, absolutely massive. So at some point, they actually did turn in 2 quarters of profits and had to be included in the S&P or could be included in the S&P 500. So the S&P 500 index committee first punted it, but eventually in 2020, they let Tesla in. And given that Elon Musk owns a fair bit of the shares, there are a few other big shareholders, let's say ARK Invest, Cathie Wood's is ARK Invest, and some really loyal retail holders that never want to sell. That meant that a lot of index funds had to scramble to buy the remaining free float. And that pushed the share price up dramatically. So Tesla's run was supercharged by index provision and just people arbitraging expected index provision. So it just goes to show how index providers and the rules they have a massive impact day to day on markets. And the other one was Greece. And Greece was a country that home of Western civilization and was a developed market for many decades. But when it hit a sticky patch in the 2010 or so because of the Eurozone debt crisis, it got relegated from developed markets to emerging markets by MSCI. At the time, it was really symbolic, of course, of just how far Greece had fallen. But in practice, it's a good thing for Greece. I mean, the stock market was bombed out anyway. For any Western market-oriented stock picker that's used to picking between like AstraZeneca and Google and Facebook and Apple, Greece was just too small to care. But in emerging markets, it kind of had a bit more of a natural home. It got a slightly higher allocation as well. So it shows sometimes being in the right index can actually be a good thing for you, even though it's a lesser index, as it were.
And it tells us a little bit about the virtues of contrarian investing at the right time. But just staying with that Tesla, when you were writing this and when you paused on the Tesla story, did something make you scratch your head and just wonder about capitalism?
Well, Tesla is a weird stock. It's not quite as egregious as, let's say, AMC and some of the other meme stocks we've seen in 2020 and 2021. But Tesla is not a stock where the price bears a lot of relation to its fundamentals, in my view. And we've seen, you know, a lot of short sellers get their face ripped off over the past 10 years in Tesla, and it keeps defying what we'd see as capitalism gravity. But yeah, fundamentally, there's lots of things that have value beyond their intrinsic worth. Gold famously has many times been described as a 3,000-year bubble. Has no real actual value for industrial purposes, but it looks shiny and people always ascribed it value. So it doesn't strike me as completely insane that stocks that say something about your identity, that you identify as a Tesla owner, both as a car owner and as a stockholder, is something that kind of gets divorced from what we see as normal capitalism, as it were.
Well, we haven't had Elon Musk on the show, but any of our listeners who can help us encourage him to come on, we'd be absolutely thrilled. Now, there are some other oddities around the indexes, or the indices, I should say, and I just want to touch on those. Unilever wanted to move from the UK to Amsterdam, but then couldn't. Google had its restricted voting issues. The UK now wants to attract more high-growth companies and reviewing its listing requirements. What should we make of this?
Indices matter. When indices were started 100 years ago, 50 years ago, it varies, they were typically adjuncts. They were just like a really boring data business started by people like the Financial Times as a service, or Dow Jones. Charles Dow, that started Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal, started the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And it wasn't that interesting at the time. And it was primarily seen as maybe a way for economists to measure economic activity. We couldn't measure GDP that well, but the stock market seemed to be a pretty decent way of doing it. But then indices later became this massively profitable industry in its own right. Because people, first of all, active managers, active investors wanted to benchmark their managers against something. Then index funds needed something to index. So it's kind of evolved massively, and in a way that I don't feel a lot of people appreciate. Even regulators don't really appreciate that what the S&P 500 Index Committee says in many ways matters more to corporate governance in America, or certainly among the big companies, than what the SEC says. What MSCI says about capital markets for China, or what they count as developed or emerging market, matters more than what a lot of individual investors might say. Even in bond markets, think of the bond indices. They all started by banks as an adjunct. They had all this data exhaust. You might as well start indices. So Lehman, the old ag in the US, or the Bank of America Master Series, Merrill Lynch Master Series for high yield. And these are just really valuable now. They're rife with potential conflicts when banks own them. We've seen what banks can do with benchmarks that they own. And they're actually quite valuable for index providers. And they have all sorts of rules that people can game and are gaming.
You just brought up fixed income. It was in my notes here to mention to you, because in my life, I've been amazed and I suppose deeply cynical about the notion that a bond index ultimately has as its largest weights those countries or companies with the greatest indebtedness. How should we think about that?
I mean, on the face of it, it's obviously madness. I mean, market cap weighting, you know, weighting by the value of a company's overall market worth and shares makes perfect sense in equities. There are maybe things you can do around the edges to be a little bit more dynamic. Broadly, it makes sense. But just transplanting that into the fixed income world obviously means, yeah, you weight to the most indebted companies and countries. So Japan has a mammoth weight in the global ag, for example. The biggest, most indebted high-yield companies in the world have massive allocations in corporate indices. In practice, however, bond indices were designed never to be tracked. It's very clear from their architecture and how they're built that these were never designed to be investable products built on them. But in practice, we do see the same thing, that active managers do on average do better in fixed income because some of these indices are so dumb, it's just easier to beat them. But broadly speaking, active managers, when you adjust for issues like a systematic tilt towards credit and junkier parts of credit, actually don't do that much better than active equity managers either. But I agree that passive products in fixed income is an issue with a lot of hair on it.
Well, that allows us, I suppose, to now turn to the questions, the dark sides and the issues. And when I reviewed your materials and others, the critics are large and they are vocal and they appear to be growing. Al Gore, I think, commented that I think large passive investors have a real difficult decision to make. Do they want to continue to finance the destruction of human civilization? Paul Singer of Elliott Capital Management, a famed hedge fund manager, argues that index funds are devouring capitalism. And I think it was Bernstein, research house, who said passive investing is worse than Marxism. Now, how do you think about this?
Well, so broadly speaking, and there are many facets to this, I divide lines of criticism into four areas, which I think have varying degrees of validity. One is some of the issue we talk about, the product proliferation. Innovation, it's a fun word, but innovation in financial services quite often ends in ruin, right? There's lots of really dumb stuff that is happening with index funds. Now, if the original idea between passive investing index funds is that most people actually do a pretty bad job of investing, I don't see a meaningful qualitative or quantitative difference between punting on an individual biotech stock or punting on a biotech ETF, essentially. And there's all sorts of dumb, like funky stuff that people are doing, especially with ETFs these days. I actually do think that has some validity, but fundamentally it's capitalism. You create a product, if it has a market, it survives, and if it doesn't, it dies. So on a personal level, I think there's lots of iffy stuff going on, but broadly speaking, who am I to dictate what other people are allowed to buy or sell? You know, I don't think Manchester United is a great football club. I'd love to see them get relegated to Conference League, but unfortunately, Liverpool can't win every year, and it might be a little bit boring if it did. The second issue, I think, the index providers. We talked about the index providers have accrued a lot of power on the quiet and almost not by deliberately. They don't want this power necessarily, but they do have it. I think that's going to be a rising issue. And then the third issue, you know, this is like parts of the Paul Singer argument and other people. The argument that passive is now so massive that it is distorting markets, making them more fragile, more volatile, more prone to boom and busts. And I can see all sorts of individual examples where index funds and ETFs and passive investing is clearly having an impact. And I think even fans of it like me just need to accept that, that nothing can grow this big without having a footprint on markets. Now, fundamentally, do I think that footprint is any worse than the impact of mutual funds when they were born 100 years ago, or hedge funds, or private equity, or venture capital? I always think of markets as this fantastically dynamic, complex ecosystem. It's a complex system that changes all the time with as the participants rise and fall. Index trusts were dominant 100 years ago, investment trusts, but now they're just not that many of them around. They all affect markets. Now, are index funds worse than all these other forms of investing? I'm not sure. I don't think hedge funds are evil, nasty people. I don't think index funds are either. It's just a strategy, and it's a viable strategy. So I think that point of criticism is weak sauce. Now, the area I do think is a big issue, and this is what Al Gore talked a little bit about, and certainly Paul Singer as well, is that just the economics of indexing means that the big are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And we talk about the big three. So Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock, together manage over $20 trillion now, just vast sums. But in reality, State Street isn't growing as quickly as Vanguard and BlackRock, who are the dominant leaders in index funds and ETFs. And those players are almost inevitably, it's hard to not see a scenario where their growth trajectory doesn't just continue. And that just means that in the foreseeable future, in 10, 20, 30 years, these funds are de facto going to control the vast majority of shareholding vote of every major company in the US and most companies in the world. I don't think they particularly want that responsibility, but even shying away from it is a decision with consequences. And I just think at some point, we need to worry about the societal impact of this hugely narrow duopoly in investment management and what that means for corporate governance around the world. I mean, I have sympathy with these players. I mean, they get criticized if they don't do anything. Then people like Paul Singer say essentially they're lazy and they're slothful owners, the passive owners. And if they do too much, they get criticized for being activists, that they're pushing companies to be woke or take climate change too seriously, or they're not taking it seriously enough. Or they should do more on gun rights, or they should do less. They should exclude China. No, they should include China. I mean, this is a really difficult tightrope for them to walk. So the defining challenge, I think, not just for BlackRock and Vanguard and to a lesser extent State Street, but kind of for markets and maybe capitalism for the next decade or two.
I was reminded when you talked about unsuccessful financial innovation, it was the late Paul Volcker who said the greatest innovation of the previous 30 years was the cash machine. But ESG, Warren Buffett, often seen as the great investment thinker and moral voice, is not a fan of ESG. And he, I think his point, which you referred to in the book, is that many shareholders would in reality prefer companies to focus on making profit. So we know the battle lines that are being drawn up here. If you sell your holding in BP or Exxon, for example, and it goes from being in an active pool to a passive pool, who's there to encourage the company on that journey of change?
Well, both active and passive make different arguments about why they're the best owners. So active owners say, look, we can sell. Well, that's the ultimate action that an active investor can do. If we don't like companies and we can engage with them, and that's what we do, they use ESG as part of their marketing sale. We can engage with companies. We can push them in the right direction. Passive investors say, well, hang on. You guys can sell. We can't sell. We're permanent owners. So we care way more about this. Because essentially, if they argue it to a company, a board might say, well, you're just going to go away in the next quarter. You're like pesky hedge fund or asset manager, ABC Capital. You're not going to be around here next year. They just get ignored. It's hard to ignore a BlackRock or Vanguard. They're going to be part of your shareholder registry forever. I think both of those arguments are true and wrong in different ways. But fundamentally, I'm in Team Buffett here. I'm not sure that we should be relegating or almost kind of pushing aside massively touchy political public policy issues to fund managers. I think this is a job for democratically elected, or less in some countries, politicians that we elect to choose to decide these things, and we can have a public debate. I do not think it's healthy for any country to shunt these issues onto asset managers. I think there are all sorts of things we should be doing about climate change, and we should be doing way more. I think the ESG trend gets a little bit silly at times. Should we push BP to not pump out oil? I mean, it gets silly. And at some point, people are going to make massive amounts of money from just basically being ESG agnostic or anti-ESG, because they're going to be able to pick up systematically cheap companies on the other side, dumped by index funds and active managers that can't hold them because they have these really strict ESG mandates.
Well, I agree. And with big cash flow yields and the world still needing 85% of its energy to come from fossil fuels, etc. But just want to come back to your point about passive, who the passive industry being able to argue that they're permanent capital, essentially. They're permanent capital at zero cost. So where is the incentive or even really the willingness to use that ownership in any helpful way?
Oh, very good point. And this is what the active people say. And that's where I kind of agree that, like, if you're Vanguard and you're basically giving, let's say, Vanguard 500 fund, 3 basis points, I mean, you make a decent amount of money off that because it isn't very expensive to run. But do you make so much money that you can have a massive team to engage consistently with every single 500 company? No. And in reality, I mean, active managers do this as well, but this gets shunted off to shareholder proxy companies, the ISS and Glassloot overwhelmingly, companies that exist solely to take away that headache from all investors, really. And then you engage in the actually important stuff. And I have some sympathy with that. There are so many votes that a BlackRock or Vanguard or Fidelity as an active manager doesn't need to get engaged with. Fairly routine stuff, and you can push that over to ISS and Glass-Lewis. But have they got enough people to do substantive corporate governance work across the tens of thousands of companies they manage money in? I don't think so. It gets very high level, but then you get to the point, it's like Goldilocks. Are they doing too much, too little, or just enough? Broadly speaking, they get criticized on both sides for doing too little on corporate governance. Other people say they're doing way too much.
So we were lucky enough to have Sir Chris Hone of TCI on the podcast a few months back. And of course, he has launched this say on climate, which is really stirring up corporate responses to behavior that may be deemed to be sort of inappropriate, which I suppose would reinforce the argument that active can be really a force for change. I'd like to talk about Japan because I'm old enough to have seen the bull and the bear market. And as I was thinking about this conversation, I went back to 1989 and checked my notes, and Japan was 43% of the world market capitalization. And its valuations, as some will remember, I think put the market on a P of about 70. And just for the record, five Japanese banks were amongst the 10 largest corporations in the world. And if you invested in a global ETF, you had 43% of your allocation in Japan, which then fell 70%. And that doesn't seem very prudent.
No. If you buy a passive fund, you're buying yesterday's winners and tomorrow's losers, essentially. Fundamentally, the issue is those things are unknowable ahead of time. I mean, you could have said that, let's say technology. I mean, I remember people saying technology was massively overvalued in 2010. Insane. Why would you buy Apple, Facebook, Netflix, Google, Microsoft at those times? It's insane. They're never going to. There has to be mean reversion. Hasn't be? Not yet. I mean, you would have lost out on a sensational decade of big tech returns if you had tilted away, and many active managers have. Now, maybe technology bombs out tomorrow. In practice, we just don't know. What I do know is that a global index fund that invested even in Japan at the peak in global stocks when Japan had its peak allocation would still have done better than 90% of all active managers over the subsequent decade. Even if you'd invested in, for example, let's say a classic case, this was a seminal study back in the day, CRISP, the Chicago Center for Security Research, pricing, something like that. It was founded by Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch really wanted to sell stocks to people, and they wanted to sell stocks are amazing. And this was back in the 60s, and the SEC said, sorry, bud, you can't market that unless you can actually prove it. And nobody actually knew that stocks did better than bonds in the long run. So they got the University of Chicago to actually do all the data. And that was the first study that showed this. This was like the fundamental database behind index funds as well. But they showed that even if you'd invested at the absolute peak, just before the great crash of 1929, through all the Great Depression, you would still have made around 8% a year and done better than the average active investor. And it just goes to show that we can say these things in hindsight all the time, but broadly speaking, human active managers are really bad at this and are getting worse. And this isn't because they're getting worse. I think back in the day, if you were a really good investor in the 60s, you could probably do well. In the 90s, you could be an exceptional investor and do well. I think today, markets are so hard to beat because there are so many PhDs out there, so many CFAs, so many MBAs. People have dedicated their entire lives to beating the markets, that just being exceptional is not enough. You have to be a generational talent to be able to consistently beat most developed markets, both stocks and bonds, in the long run. And that's just quantitatively true. So I'm not a passive jihadist in that I don't think it can be done. I don't think it's just luck. This is the Gene Farm argument. Are they easy to find? No. And even if you find them, can you invest in them? Probably not. Medallion's not taking my money. I can tell you that much.
Well, that's very well expressed. So let's look ahead. You, in your book, quote you, barring a cataclysm, it's possible that within a generation, the majority of all the global investment industry's money will be in an index fund or strategy of some kind. And that, of course, begs the question, And it's been referred to, I think, by Gary Stenhardt in Barron's, that essentially there's an ecosystem off which everybody is feeding. And if that happens, isn't there a industry ripe for disintermediation and secular disemployment?
People have been predicting this ever since the 1970s. I remember reading some of the Wall Street Journal clippings from the 70s about the birth of index funds. Is absolutely hilarious. Like, a lot of the stuff we discussed today was being discussed then. People saying, I found this quote, those guys, oh my God, this is going to make a lot of portfolio managers making $16,000 a year unemployed. Lo and behold, there are more portfolio managers, more hedge fund managers than ever before. And they're making more money than ever before. So I struggle to see investment management as an industry that is falling under massive pressure from the competition. As much as like the industry is feeling cost pressures and price pressures because of the rivalry from index funds and passive investing, I mean, broadly speaking, this was an industry that was, until just 2 or 3 years ago, more profitable than Google. In the listed asset management industry in the US had profit margins greater than the FANG stocks. So can that halve in the coming decade or two and many portfolio managers still be gainfully employed and still make lots of money? Probably yes. I mean, it's probably bad because of all the resulting work. If you're a sell-side analyst, your entire life is basically dedicated to helping portfolio managers, I think that's going to be a harder thing. If you're a financial journalist writing about active managers make great press. That's not great either. That world slowly shrinking is not going to be good for financial advertising. It's not going to be good for all sorts of parts of the ecosystem that basically depends on the global investment industry. But, you know, where jobs fall off, new jobs are born.
Yep. And in fact, I remember two particular conversations. Peter Harrison, our first guest, head of Schroders and the Money Maze podcast, and then Anne Robinson from Fidelity, both making really just a very simple and straightforward case for why it is the investment management industry is such a great industry to be in and lots of secular growth ahead. But before I turn to some general questions, Robin, so you've surveyed the data, you've understood the numbers, you still have this reservoir of support for the existence of alpha. How would you think about managing your own portfolio today?
I can tell you my portfolio is very long Norwegian real estate and UK real estate. The only advice I ever feel comfortable giving people is being really lazy, buying a broad, diverse group of index funds across fixed income and equities, and periodically rebalancing, and then not thinking about until retirement. And broadly speaking, I can say that quantitatively, the odds are very good that you're going to do better than the average active manager and the average, frankly, pension fund, as we can see from the data, over the next 20, 30, 40 years. Now, you might not make the rates of returns that we have in the past 30 years, which has been just a golden era for financial markets. The next 30 years could be pretty grim. But I feel fairly confident that if you invest passively over the next 30 years, the vast majority of people, unless you happen to be Ken Griffin, are going to do better in a passive portfolio.
You and Warren Buffett together on the same hymn sheet. Robin, I'd like to ask you some general questions, and I'd like to talk about the business of journalism because you've seen it up close and personal. You've got this book, which is about to be launched. You're very widely followed and admired. And so for the young listeners that we have who might be thinking about journalism as a career, your advice would be?
I think it's really hard to survive being a mediocre journalist in most areas, just because the competition is insane. So I think go into it with eyes open. I get to talk to really smart, interesting people and learn from them every day. And if you like a job that is going to be insecure, not particularly well paid, but incredibly stimulating and going to keep you enlightened and fun every day, then yeah, journalism, and especially financial journalism and economics journalism, is a great way to go.
Seems like it mirrors being on the Money Maze podcast as a host. So you've met lots of interesting people, but who would you most like to have lunch with a lunch with the FT and you?
I've long wanted to have lunch with Jim Simons, the founder of Renaissance Technologies, the hedge fund. I love quants. Like I said, I always wanted to be a physicist. So I'm always intrigued and interested in anything that's like a little bit more systematic and quantitative. So quants fascinate me. And Jim Simons is the gold standard of, well, frankly, investment management period. I mean, his results are just phenomenal. Someone like Ken Griffin could be interesting. Cliff Asness at AQR, anybody who has a chance to talk to him at any point, he's just an incredibly engaging, interesting, fun speaker. That's always interesting. I did love talking to people like Bill Sharp, Gene Farmer, Harry Markowitz for my book. I mean, these are people that, you know, if I'm half as smart at half their age, I'll be doing pretty well. I mean, these are people that still have intellectual sizzle out the Yahoo in their 80s. I mean, they're still working. I think that was just fascinating. And I don't know. I mean, Larry Fink could be interesting. These financial titans, they tend to get pretty guarded around journalists, though. So lunch with the FT, they'll be a little bit more careful than they are in private. There are some exceptions. Like Cliff Asness is how he seems is exactly how he is. And I once had lunch with the FT with Bill Gross, which was fascinating. He's a utterly transparent and open and honest person for good and bad. But that was fascinating.
That's a very interesting list of people. As you say in your book, the geeks who thought up this whole passive investing have gone mainstream. It reminded me of Bill Gates's comment, which is, be nice to geeks, they can end up being your boss. Tell me, what are the surprises that we might encounter in the next decade in financial services?
I think the next change, the next big revolution we're going to see is going to be in asset allocation. So we still pay CIOs and financial advisors, on big level CIOs, on the small level financial advisors, or, you know, newspaper journalists to kind of come with tips and ideas on this. And it's very unrigorous in many ways, and it costs a lot of money. So I think asset allocation is going to be an area where we're going to see massive changes in the next decade or two, not least because, frankly, the returns from just market beta are going to be extremely subdued, I suspect, over the next generation or so. And the finance industry is going to be broadly okay. And broadly speaking, most investors and most people are going to be served by a vibrant financial and investing ecosystem, even better in the coming era than they were in the past era. I'm an optimist on those things. I think people get way too gloomy way too often.
Well, I think that's a really nice summary. I would also add that for those of us who are old timers, it's actually quite fun trying to pick winning stocks, despite the evidence that I shouldn't be doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Robin, your book, Trillions, Why Passive Investing Beats Active, will be on our show email. The links will be all on our website. As I said before, absolutely mean it. It's just a terrifically assembled book, a story, an analysis, and conclusion. So well done. I also gather that you're about to become a father. So I think the Norwegian expression is lykke til. Good luck to you and your wife. And Robin, it's been just wonderful to have this conversation today.
No, thanks so much for having me on. And it's my third child, so I'm not sure if good luck, commiserations maybe is the right expression, but I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun. And always a good place to have a kid as well.
As a father of three, I was reminded that when you go from two children to three, the football analogy is it goes from man-to-man marking to zone coverage. So,
yes, and the third one feels already in the belly like it's going to be a slightly more active than even the first two. So I'm girding myself as I'm my own personal volatility in the coming few years.
Well, very, very good luck. Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.